Mitch Stoddard for the appellants, Conway and, Davis and Sherry Conway, if it may please the court. Your Honors, there's no legal distinction between the case that we just discussed and this case. And the facts don't involve dual tracking in this case. This is an instance where my clients never even occupied the property. They did not know about the foreclosure. Foreclosure was foreclosure over notice was sent to the unoccupied property, even though City Mortgage knew where my clients were residing at the time. I'm going to take a couple minutes, and I just wanted to take the opportunity of pointing out what life will look like should the court agree to reverse these cases, but leave the portfolio and professional debt cases intact. Because now we're going to have a situation where unlawful debt collection is not covered by the MPA, but unlawful foreclosures are covered by the MPA. And the courts, when we have different facts, are going to have to make the determination, is this more like debt collection? Is it more like unlawful foreclosures? And I would argue unlawful foreclosures are just an extreme form of debt collection. But courts that already intend to be more restrictive in their interpretations of the Merchandising Practices Act are going to gravitate towards, well, this is more like debt collection. We're not going to apply the Merchandising Practices Act, and we're going to be back up here time and time and time again on a slightly different set of facts trying to determine whether the Merchandising Practices Act applies. We're looking to the court for clarification. We're looking to the court to make the definitive determination that all of these debt collection activities, unlawful foreclosures, get picked up by the Merchandising Practices Act. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, the acts alleged in the previous case are within the National Mortgage Settlement, but there was a provision that said that we are not discharging any private causes of action if somebody decides to avail themselves of the settlement. Okay. So they operate independently.
In tandem.
In tandem. But it's based on the same statute here, which is 407.020. And
counsel, ordinarily 407 doesn't apply to banks or credit unions or insurance companies. What brings these defendants inside the reach of the AG's office in a private action under 407?
I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, so the Department of Finance deals with state-chartered institutions. These are not state-chartered institutions. They're chartered under the National Bank Act. And for a number of years up until about 2010, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency had asserted that state AGs have no authority whatsoever to regulate anything with banking, to use their little FTC acts against a nationally chartered bank. In 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Cuomo v. Clearinghouse, where the court said that is incorrect. National banks are subject to the same state laws as any other general corporation. And so the general statute of marketplace regulation is the MPA. And I think your point touches on kind of a broader conception of the case before here. We're not asking the court to extend some narrow subject matter statute like a securities fraud statute or something like that to some previously unregulated area or trying to extend our jurisdiction. The MPA, like all little FTC acts, is the catch-all provision. It is a general statute designed to generally regulate the marketplace, and all we are asking is that it be applied generally.
Now let me ask you my question very quickly about the FTC Act.
Sure, sure.
Does the FTC Act, section 16 CFR 433.2, does that apply to banks like or Citicorp?
I have traditionally seen it applied to auto financing. I am not sure if the OCC had some kind of regulation out there, because they tend to assert their dominance against the FTC of their right to regulate national banks. But I will say this, even if the FTC Act applied, which I think it certainly provides the rationale, the danger of the portfolio case is it might not be able to overcome it, because the FTC anti-holder rule says you don't get to avail yourself of the affirmative defense of the holder in due course. What's really striking about the portfolio decision and its danger is that it really reworks the actual heart of 407.020 by removing, by overly restricting a substantive element.
And your office, way before your time, with Harvey Tettelbaum and Jack Danforth, and actually Kenny Rothman, there's a whole new course exception in the state of Missouri.
Right. There is a state statute on it as well. And what we're asking here that the court do, we're not asking that the court create some kind of technical liability for the actors in this case. We are just asking to go back to the principle that this court handed down in Gibbons, which was, if you can identify the actor who engaged in the unlawful act, the deception, the unfairness, then there is a cause of action against that person for their conduct. And so we're not seeking to hold defendants accountable or arguing that the court should hold them accountable for something that someone else did. In each of these cases, it is the defendants who are engaged in the actual act itself.
And if the state of Missouri, one of the reasons, of course, why City Mortgage is running a lot of mortgages through Missouri is because the second mortgage law has no usury rate, or did not have a usury rate, so is a good place, like Market Bank, it's a good place to run these mortgages. If they're going to avail themselves of our loose interest rates in Missouri to run all these mortgages through Missouri, then they should, you should have the ability to deal with them as the Attorney General.
We certainly believe that there is an importance of having the Attorney General there to protect Missourians from abuse. And with the portfolio decisions, it does create an exception that doesn't just bar these legitimate claimants from the court doors, but also bars our office as chief law enforcement officer from doing something about it. In both of these cases, there's no one who could be sued but under the MPA, under the logic of the portfolio cases. Either the link is broken because they surreptitiously take an assignment and portfolio provides a defense, or they simply claim that I didn't engage in the act, so you can't hold me accountable for it either.
And the statute gives you far more powers than a private right of action of injunctions and the cease and desist orders to protect the people in Missouri. That's what you're there for.
I would agree with that. And that's why the MPA has to be preserved for these sorts of situations, these broad types of consumer abuses that are systematic. There are perhaps other ways to get to it with a quo warranto action or something somewhat tenuous, but none of them provide 407.100's toolbox of equitable remedies.
Say that in the portfolio case that the appellate court chose the wrong option definition of in connection with. Using that same dictionary, which one would you have chosen? Which one did the legislature intend?
I would take that in two parts, Judge Fisher. The first is, I think you have to define it as a phrase, which has a unique meaning. But if I was going to define the one-word connection out of the Merriam-Webster, the first definition, I believe, was logically related to, which is a broader conception than just the relationship in fact definition. I think also the problem beyond the definition of portfolio is perhaps the Eastern District meant this to be dicta, but it has been applied as black letter, which are the two portfolio rationales identified in the brief, that somebody needs to be present at the initial transaction, or it has to relate to a claim or representation made at that transaction, the conduct. And those principles are being applied like they are gospel black letter, and that is punting a lot of these cases out of the courtroom prior to submission of the fact finder. Gibbons made sure, this court in Gibbons said very expressly that whether or not a party or a defendant is at the table when that transaction occurs is immaterial. The court was very careful to focus on that the MPA applies to any person, regardless of the hat that they wear due to formal legal privity. And although the portfolio cases and the lower court's decision in this try to distinguish those cases by saying, well, that happened prior to the transaction, when we have the before, during, or after language, that really renders that distinction factually irrelevant because the statute doesn't care when the conduct occurs. Likewise, when we talk about relating to a specific claim or representation, that is an overly meticulous way to look at the statute. It starts to morph the MPA more into looking like a common law fraud action where you have to identify express statements and claims in order to show liability. It also ignores situations where there are omissions or duties that are implied by law that need no express statement in the time of the sale. Good faith and fair duty, which has been alleged as an unfair practice, doesn't need a claim or representation to be actionable. An omission of a material fact, by definition, is not going to be said at the time of the initial sale.
So opposing counsel in the earlier case, and I know we'll hear from counsel in this case, said there has to be a violation of the terms as on the date that they're originally signed in order to come within the MPA. I take it, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think it ignores that not all sales are factually the same. A sale of a donut is a very discrete, granular period of time. I give cash, the donut is given, I eat the donut, it's over. But when we're looking at a mortgage transaction, those terms may be modified. They may evolve. Performance is contemplated for 30 years. To really understand the scope of the sale, you can't really deal with it in the abstract and try to create a universal statement like the portfolio cases did. You have to ask, what's being sold here? What is the merchandise at issue? Because certain types of merchandise like home mortgages and loans are simply going to have broader application of acts that would be brought into the MPA than a simple donut.
What weight then do we give to the recent cases that have come out of the federal district courts, both in the east and west side? I mean, I realize that we're not bound by
them.
But so, you know, what persuasive weight do we give to the fact that they, in cases similar to these, you know, post-sale, wrongful foreclosure alleged, and both Eastern and Western District Federal Court has held the MMPA did not apply?
I'm really glad you asked that, because although there is a volume of federal authority, there's nothing behind it but portfolio cases being applied under the Erie Doctrine. Mm-hmm. Federal courts have to apply the highest level court decision that they have, and portfolio is out there. And I'd note that the only other district that has dealt with the portfolio rationale was the Western District in the Peel case, which is cited. And although it's dicta, they strongly criticized it. So this is not overturning some broad consensus of portfolio's logical integrity. It's just the Erie Doctrine appearing to give weight to something that really is not in the spirit of the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court?
You may proceed.
I'm Amy Thompson. I represent the respondents in this action, City Mortgage and the Federal National Mortgage Association, or Fannie Mae. Your Honors, regardless of the various concerns expressed by the Attorney General and by the appellants in this action, we're here today to decide a single issue, which is whether or not a specific category of conduct does or does not fall under the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act, as that statute is currently written. This case, it's important to note, just does pose a slightly different question than is at issue in the Watson matter. This case does not involve a signed completed loan modification agreement. It does not involve any questions as to whether or not the loan modification agreement is a new transaction or a new sale, or whether the loan modification agreement relates back to the original loan transaction. This case strictly deals with foreclosure activity and the treatment of an insurance escrow account set up after the property was damaged by fire and in connection with the foreclosure. Your Honors, the MPA regulates commercial practices in connection with the sale or advertisement of merchandise. The Missouri legislature chose to regulate sales and advertising. At the time that the MPA was originally drafted in 1967, the FTC Act, which generally regulated trade or commerce, was already in existence. Legislatures all over the country were at the time beginning to pass these little FTC Acts, not all of which, but many of which also followed the lead of the FTC and just generally regulated trade or commerce, or perhaps all consumer activity. Instead, the Missouri legislature chose not to use that language and chose to regulate unfair practices in connection with the sale or advertisement. Now, appellants suggest that the MPA should be read basically to cover all commercial activity involving consumers. And the argument championed by appellants that foreclosures fall under the MPA because at some point in the past there was a sale untethers the alleged wrongdoing from anything that the Missouri legislature ever intended to outlaw.
Well, the definition of merchandise includes real estate.
The definition of merchandise does include real estate. The definition of merchandise does indeed include the sale of credit.
And originally real estate was not included, and also the Division of Finance, as good Judge Wilson pointed out, Division of anything under the Division of Finance and was not included in the Unfair and Deceptive Practices Act. All these things were originally, but there's been an evolution as time went by.
There has been an evolution, and we would agree with that. However, we would posit.
So an evolution towards more rights to the consumer and the Attorney General dealing with those issues. They didn't restrict more, they actually expanded it more.
They have indeed expanded it, but they have not expanded it to the extent of mirroring the language of other state FTC statutes or little FTC statutes generally regulating all conduct in trade or commerce.
But we can't look to them. I mean, the intent is the same of having a protection of consumers of FTC Act and be remedial. We can't look to them for some guidance.
The language of the statutes are very different. And in that result, it seems that the statutes should not really be looked to for guidance. They do not say or mean the same thing. And in fact, this court has determined Nixon versus the Telco Directory Publishing cases, which I can provide a cite for later if you like, that this court recognized that Missouri statute is different than the FTC Act.
A number of them have very similar language and have found coverage, however, that it's covered by the MPA, by their version.
There are a few
version.
That do have similar similar language. However, few have actually looked at the in connection with language.
So is it your view that your obligation of good faith and fair dealing ends on the day that the initial documents are signed?
No, Your Honor, but that is a contract issue. The day that the documents
are signed.
Well,
that's an MPA, a violation of the MPA, if in connection with the sale, including mortgage financing, you violate your duty to act with good faith and fair dealing. That's under the MPA. That's one of the violations alleged.
Well, under the MPA, the unfair practice has to relate to the initial sale.
Yes.
Not just say
initial. It says sale.
All right. Okay, so let's look at what the sale is.
Yes, exactly.
Under the Merchandising Practices Act, sale is defined as a sale, a lease, an attempt to sell, or an offer to sell. The definition of sale under the MPA does not encompass subsequent performance.
Well, then why does it say before, during, and after?
Well, Your Honor, before, during, and after does indeed modify the in connection with the sale requirement. However, the legislature chose not to put the before, during, and after up in the first sentence of 407.020 as part of the definition of what constitutes an unlawful practice. Rather, they put it in the last sentence of that provision, indicating that if an action is decreed an unlawful practice, then it violates the statutes, whether it's before, during, and after.
Right.
Therefore, we have to assume that the legislature meant something less than before, during, and after.
We have to presume it meant something, though.
It does indeed.
Things done in connection with the sale, whether before, during, or after, if they constitute an unlawful practice, can be actionable under the MPA.
We do have to assume that, but under the terms of the statute, that does not mean that in connection with a sale is rendered superfluous.
Right, exactly right.
The conduct that's at issue here, you only have a right to undertake to foreclose as a function of the documents that comprise the sale, correct?
That's correct.
So, I mean, this wasn't a statutory right, this wasn't a common law right, this was a contractual right.
That is correct.
So, unlike the prior case, the the right you were exercising grew out of the and certainly to that extent would seem to be in connection with the sale.
Well, the sale was concluded at the origination of the mortgage.
And where do you get that out of the statute?
Well,
You're still paying for it. You're still buying it. You're still financing. The financing of the sale. How's that not in connection?
The financing of the sale, the repayment, is ancillary. Is it just simply an ancillary action to the sale itself?
So it's not connected with the sale.
The financing might be connected, but that doesn't mean that every action relating to servicing the mortgage later on down the line is connected to the sale.
So can you give me an example of then how the before, during, and after, what kind of conduct would fall underneath that? The phraseology in under this foreclosure situation?
Certainly. For instance, there might be a continuum of activity. Wrongful conduct that occurred at the time of the initial origination of the mortgage. Misrepresentations or wrongful omissions as to disclosures. That then carries on through servicing and that ultimately results in a wrongful foreclosure.
Misrepresentations, for example, what kind of misrepresentations?
Perhaps misrepresentations in different documents relating to the interest rate that's charged.
That's not after the sale, though. They're talking about on the day of the sale.
That's right. There would be representations at the time of the sale that then continue on, and maybe there are unfair practices later on.
What kind of unfair practice we're asking? Because everything you seem to make it before or during.
Well, Your Honor, if someone was foreclosing based on wrongful conduct, they were foreclosing based on the fact that the interest rates had gone sky high because of a failure to disclose. There still be wrongful acts later on, after the sale, but there are also wrongful conduct. The sale itself was also infected with the wrongful conduct.
You're a very good lawyer, but when the legislature says something like before, during, and after, I've seen some of them said from the beginning of the world to the end of the world. That seems to cover the whole world. I mean, the whole time continuum before, during, and after. I don't know what comes in between, but you're doing a good job of explaining.
I think that a very good example of how the before, during, and after language can apply is the Peel versus Credit Acceptance Corporation case. In that case, which the Western District acknowledged did not or would still have been the same under the portfolio recovery analysis, there was wrongful conduct connected to the original transaction. The original transaction was itself infected. In addition, the wrongful conduct, which related to the fact that the seller had never turned over the title to the vehicle, that failure went to the very heart, went to the very benefit of the bargain of the original transaction, went to the validity of the original transaction. So under those two circumstances, where you have a party who was originally involved in the sale, not in privity, but it originally involved in the sale, you have original sale that's infected with wrongdoing on its own. And indeed, you have a piece of wrongdoing that affects the very validity of the statute. It's directly material to that original transaction. In that matter, the before, during, and after language did indeed apply.
But to agree with your argument, it sounds to me like we have to agree with your premise that the financing of a sale is not made in connection with the sale. Is that correct?
The financing of the sale may be in connection with the sale. The wrongful conduct, every piece of wrongful conduct that relates to servicing of a loan over a 30-year period does not mean that that is in connection with the original.
You're saying the performance of an executory contract is not always in connection.
That's exactly right. The purchase of credit is the purchase of the present right to money in exchange for future promises to pay. The collection of that payment does not mean that the sale is continuing. Sale is typically...
But why isn't it in connection with it? That's the question.
Well, Your Honor, sale is typically understood in the plain language to be a finite transaction, not a continuum that goes on into infinity or into a lifetime. So to say that something is in connection with a sale that continues as long as you're making payments on a particular purchase stretches the term sale into something that it's never been intended to cover.
Well, the question, though, is what the MPA intend to cover by using that broad language?
The MPA, if one looks at the way this typically has been interpreted, the term sale, both under the UCC and under other statutes, encompasses the completion of performance of the seller by handing over the merchandise, handing over the money. Under the UCC, for instance, the sale is determined to be completed at the time that the seller completes its performance by delivering the merchandise, whether or not a security interest is retained in the merchandise because there are going to be payments made. That's a typical understanding of what a sale is. A sale is not a continuing device that goes on so long as you happen to be making payments. Therefore, I think we have to assume that the Merchandising Practices Act was intended to cover consequences relating to the origination of a mortgage to the extent that it was ever intended to cover mortgages, which it probably wasn't at the time, but has since been interpreted as in covering that.
Now, are you preempted by any of these? I mean, for example, I mentioned 16 CFR 433.2. Are you you would know because you're Citicorp, but are you exempted from any hold on due course doctrine in the state of Missouri or from the FTC for the control of the currency or whatever other groups that regulate you?
Well, Your Honor, that is to some extent a fact intensive issue because it looks at what kind of disclosures were made, and those issues are not in the record. Therefore, I can't make a definitive statement.
Of course, Michael Perchok's reason for this in the FTC was the only people who could really police the marketplace are Citicorp or Wells Fargo and who buy the paper, because otherwise there's no you're in the position better than anyone else to police the marketplace. And that's why they set it up that way.
I guess I don't take your meaning, Teitelbaum, that I guess that the purchasers are themselves supposed to police the marketplace.
Who are?
You're talking about people who are the assignees of a mortgage.
No, the people who police it. Michael Perchok, the whole idea of that whole deal and the hold on due course doctrine being sort of held in disfavor was that the people who are the purchasers of the paper are more able to police the marketplace for bad acting than the individual consumers, because you're national corporations, trillion-dollar corporations, and you can deal with that issue better than the consumer with caveat emptor to figure out what they're doing. That was the whole purpose of the doing away with the hold on due course. So when you bought paper, you had to know that, well, this company was okay or wasn't okay, or we wouldn't buy the paper, or we'd suffer some losses. That was the whole premise.
Well, Your Honor, that's the very point of this discussion, which is there was nothing to police at the time that transaction would have occurred, because nothing wrong occurred in the origination of that mortgage. Therefore, that's the very point that is being made here, that there was nothing wrong. There's nothing been alleged wrong with the origination of that mortgage, with the sale of that mortgage, that somebody later on, an assignee, could have policed. What appellants are alleging or encouraging is nothing less than a wholesale hijacking by the MPA of wrongful foreclosure law and breach of contract law in connection with a consumer transaction. There will be no need in any consumer transaction, certainly not in loan transactions, for the law of contract if every plaintiff can bring a Missouri Practices Act claim with attorney's fees and punitive damages.
But the Attorney General can't police it. The private individuals can't do it. I mean, it's the reality of the marketplace. If the Attorney General for the state of Missouri can't police the consumer laws in the state of Missouri as the MPA gives them the power, incredible power to do, then no one's policing it in the state of Missouri. No one could actually advocate against Citicorp.
The remedial purposes of the statute do not justify reading the statute just to cover everything that the Attorney General would like to police. If the text of the statute does not give the Attorney General that authority, then the Attorney General does not have that authority, unless it's available under other statutes. The remedial purposes of a statute are not a justification for expanding the scope.
I'm sorry, I used up your time.
Excuse me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
I think that you can illustrate the problems with the approach offered by the respondent by looking at the situation from a 30,000-foot view. When it comes to instituting foreclosure, there's a sufficient connection to the mortgage for the respondent to do that. When it comes to withholding escrow funds, they have a sufficient connection to the original transaction to hold on to those funds, and they even have a sufficient connection to modify the original terms put forward in that initial sale. But if flipped and brought into court, magically that connection becomes so tenuous that a consumer is not able to sue them under the MPA, and by extension, the Attorney General can't do anything. Trying to hold those two propositions in one's head at the same time is frankly difficult at best and doesn't really go forward with the logic that the statute calls for. And the part of the misconception here is thinking that when the sale could be determined to be ceased or completed, that somehow the MPA's liability or the MPA's reach shuts off. And that simply isn't the case with the language of the statute. Respondent cites to three states that have a statute that talks about a misrepresentation in the sale of merchandise versus in connection with the sale of merchandise. For the proposition that the legislature could have elected to use that option if more breadth was needed. But that simply doesn't make sense. Consider this. If I say I made a statement in the oral argument at the Supreme Court, that's a very limited universe of statements that I'm saying before you all today, and when this is over and I walk out the door, those statements wouldn't be part of it. But if I was to say I made these statements in connection with the argument at the Missouri Supreme Court today, that might cover the conversations Mr. Stoddard and I have over lunch today. So when we're looking at in connection with, there's nothing within that phrase or the way that the statute is written that would suggest that the cessation of the sale ends any possible liability. The reference to telco, certainly in that case, there were additional statutes cited as persuasive authority that were rejected. But if you look at Gibbons, there are other statutes that are cited for the proposition advanced of reading the MPA. So it really determines they are persuasive authority that the court can take one way or another. I would say that in the case of the Iowa case, the Miller versus Cuddy's, that interpretation draws on in connection with language in a variety of statutes. And almost universally, the phrase in connection with is permissive. It allows for expansive and flexible application. I think what illustrates this the best is if you just look through the Westlaw history of cases on the MPA. Prior to 2011 and the 43 years that the MPA had been on the books and this phrase had been there, if you were to look at state court decisions where an MPA case was barred from submission to the fact finder, you could count it on one hand. Now, after portfolio in just 3 years, you have the block quote of federal authority barring the doors to these claimants and the Attorney General from acting and protecting Missouri consumers. We would ask that portfolio be rejected, that a new test be articulated, and that these appellants be allowed their day in court to vindicate their rights.
I'd like to say that I appreciate your argument and Miss City Corp and Wells Fargo. It's been very instructive. I very much appreciate all your comments.
Thank you, counsel. The matter be taken under submission.